and I will rain on your parade without a sound. That's Lagwagon. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. That was supposed to be an intro for our first guest, JD Bunkus, who is still on his way hustling over here from the other side of the studio. You're good, man. You could just go in behind the camera. We're golden. Sunglasses inside. Handsome boy. JD Bunkus is going to join us. We got a full show today. We'll talk to Steph Apstein of Sports Illustrated, Dan Zimborski of Fangraphs, and Eric Kreen of The Athletic a little later. We are going to also sprinkle in some NBA draft stuff today because the Blue Jays got rained out, and also it's the NBA draft, and of course I want to do a little bit of NBA draft stuff. Jays got rained out. That game will be resumed on August 26th as part of a split doubleheader. That's a Monday down in Boston. Really no notes from it other than Yariel Rodriguez threw two additional innings after the game got rained out so that he's still stretched out. Sounds like the plan is for him to be on a three or four inning again next time he comes around, which would be Canada Day. I believe he's going to get the Canada Day start against the Astros. Jays start the first of four against the Yankees down at Rogers Center tonight. Carlos Rodon against Jose Barrios, 7 o'clock game. Should be a fun 8-game home series, even though the Toronto Blue Jays are not playing particularly well. And JD Bunkus,
the Jays aren't good.
Not good. And get this, the homestand is going to kick off with every Blue Jays fan's favorite thing.
Yeah.
A Ross Atkins media availability at 3 p.m. today.
Yeah, what do you make of this?
Nothing. It's like more in baseball than in other sports. The GM will just talk regularly. Yeah. It was actually a little weird. We hadn't heard from him as late as that May long weekend. The awkwardness is that, like, I think probably the media would have preferred to speak to Mark Shapiro at this point, because one of the biggest questions is, given how the season has gone, is Ross Atkins the one operating the trade deadline? And if so, you know, how do you feel about that, Mark Shapiro?
The next time we hear from Mark Shapiro, will he be announcing the Ross Atkins firing?
I mean, I would think so, right? Yeah. Like that's, if Shapiro is not going to speak before the trade deadline, and who knows, maybe he does that at All-Star or just before All-Star, something like that. But yeah, the last time we heard from Shapiro was mopping up the PR mess that Atkins had made at the end of last season.
Yeah.
And it was the, we have full faith, you know, look at the body of work, et cetera. It's, I don't know, like everyone's going to clown on it. I could tell you right now exactly what Ross Atkins is going to say later.
Yeah. I mean, I just spoke about this on my show previously, that Ross has never been a strong public speaker. He's never been a guy, like, it's not Masai Ujiri where I go, ooh, he's speaking?
Yeah, you said nothing, but I'm ready to roll.
Your most famous speech was that one deadline where they got all the years of control. And they went, yeah.
42 years of control?
42 years of control. People were like, hang the banners, I guess. Good job. I can't tell you another time Ross Atkins spoke where I thought this, and I've interviewed him. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed him before and tried to ask the questions directly myself. I can't remember anything that came back the other way. So I don't really care about these media conferences. I just think, to me, to borrow a wrestling term, you're a wrestling guy. I've noticed you've been getting some, like, pretty big wrestlers on the show.
HBK, Sami Zayn, no big deal.
I don't understand why the Blue Jays haven't taken the cheap pop yet. Like, there's a reason why the wrestlers say the hometown when they go out on the stage and or the catwalk. I just watched the Who Killed WCW. I'm like into the wrestling world right now. I don't understand why the Blue Jays, in a season that is cratering the way that it is, where we've got such a long runway of Ross Atkins, where people are so tired of hearing him speak, where no one cares what he has to say, where no one wants him in charge of this baseball team, that there wouldn't be a moment of, let's take the cheap pop. Even if he doesn't have a oversized value to the organization anymore, even if it's a diminished version, why would you want him in the building at this point? Why would you want to trot him out there? All it does is incite ire amongst the fan base. Like, if you have, are we taking it at 3 o'clock?
I don't know yet, actually.
Okay, sorry, I should.
I mean, it's not like a big one. It's just going to be like outside of the dugout.
But you know when you see a tweet where they go, oh, that's just rage farming.
Yeah.
We all know what that is now, right?
Yeah.
It's when someone puts a tweet out there that gets interactions because people are just mad and they know they're going to be mad. That's all you're doing with Ross Atkins speaking ever, is it's rage farming. No one's going to go, oh, yeah, that's an interesting point that he made about. No, they're just going to be mad that he's still around. So why do you think they're not taking the cheap pop?
So I think I agree with you that I would have done it by now. I mean,
I would have done that last offseason.
I was going to say, I've been very clear that that's whether for the cheap pop or on merit.
Everything that the Toronto sports right now is all last offseason. Should have been Marner trade last offseason. Should have fired Atkins last offseason.
Siakam trade.
Should have made the Siakam trade last offseason. Everything is like, oh, only Toronto had a time machine. Yeah. We would be so sick at sports.
This is why being multi-sport guys is helpful. Like, Ross Atkins is not aware what happened with the Leafs and the Raptors.
He's got someone should tell him.
Yeah.
Someone should knock on his door and be like, look at what happened with the other teams.
Sell your guy. Mikal Bridges can get back four unprotected picks. Yeah. So the reason that they haven't done it, I would imagine, is that he's a shield right now.
Yeah.
And like, I don't think Mark Shapiro is worried about his job necessarily. Like, he's, as president of the organization, that's a, there is a corporate side of that. There is the Rogers Center side of that. There is the Dunedin complex and stuff like that. It's not as much about the baseball decisions and the baseball success necessarily. But right now, Ross Atkins is a shield. He's the guy who draws that ire and stuff like that. And my guess would be if Shapiro were to actually talk and, we could do the J.D. Bunkus truth serum on him, he would be like, well, I don't really believe in like an in-season leadership change because you can't do a full GM search. And like, we would just like in those meetings in that room, minimize, Atkins's autonomy over those moves or whatever. I don't agree with it, but I think that's why the season has gone so awry at this point. It would be one thing if there was a chance to salvage this and they could sell that to the fan base. But I think it might be too far gone.
But that's why it doesn't make any sense to me is, okay, so you want him to be a shield. So you don't want to have the new GM because this is the most logical reason, right? You don't want the new GM, whoever he may be, interim, whatever. Like, what is the name? James Click?
James Click.
That's the presumed heir apparent. You don't want this guy trotted out in front of the media as they're having to make these incredibly difficult decisions and have him be stepping onto the beach for the first time and just the waves being 10 feet high, crashing down around. Are you going to trade Bo? Are you going to trade Vladdy? I kind of get that part of it. But the Shapiro job security stuff, yes, do I think he's responsible for the baseball operations when he's the president? I do. I very much do. But most people, I think, would acknowledge that from the business side of things, getting ownership to open up the pocketbook the way that he has been able to get them to. And this is a dumb one because people, it makes them mad. This is my own rage farming. The fact that they even did get a meeting and got to be used by Shohei Ohtani. Fact that he even flirted with you.
And that's our thing this is outside of Toronto. This is not like Ben Nicholson Smith and Shai Davidia and Blake Murphy constantly saying this. This is Ken Rosenthal mentioning it all the time.
No.
Jeff Passan mentioning it all the time. These are people who don't have skin in the game for making Toronto seem good. Kylie McDaniel. And Kylie McDaniel's an interesting one. So I had him, I know you've had him on your show before. Yeah. He was on my show a couple weeks ago, and he said one of the things that in talking to people around the league is a little tough to figure out, I'm paraphrasing here, but is how much of this decision making is Ross Atkins decision making, because it wouldn't be the first example, especially in baseball where the draft is right before the trade deadline, where there's a figurehead GM who doesn't actually have full autonomy to make these deals.
GM does, like most GMs don't have that. Like we learned.
Kylie gave me an example of a time when he was in a major league front office and they got told after the deadline that by a GM who got fired that was like, that was a reasonable trade negotiation, but I was getting fired and I just hadn't been fired yet, so I couldn't do that. I'm not suggesting that's the case, but it is like you read Ken Rosenthal's piece, and I know it came up during your show, so you haven't got to read it yet, but Ken Rosenthal had a big piece on the Jays today at The Athletic, and it's like, if the nut is the Jays look like certain sellers, but will almost certainly wait as long as possible to do that. But there are a lot of questions in there about like who are teams dealing with and are the Jays operating this trade deadline in a save your job environment? And what does that mean? That's not how you want to make long-term decisions for the fate of the franchise.
Yeah, I don't like that.
No.
This is what I was trying to make clear is I think Shapiro is pretty clearly safe in all of this.
Yeah, like I think so as well.
He just renovated the ballpark. It's been a massive success.
And president of baseball operations, you get one GM,
sure,
right?
But that's it. Is and what I would also say too, who do you think could have done a better job than Shapiro at this point in terms of again the books, the development of the Dunedin stuff, the way the organization is perceived from a player standpoint? Did you see Justin Turner the other day? Like I do think that is a lot of what Shapiro has accomplished. Do I hold him responsible for this season especially? Yes, I do. Yeah. I don't think people view them as like worlds apart. And this is what I don't get about keeping the Atkins as the meat shield thing. Why? No one's confused. Like, no one thinks that Shapiro isn't complicit in the baseball stuff. No one's like, you think he's just been sitting around like, do whatever you want with the baseball team. Like, I'll just be over here making sure we got Looney Dogs set up.
I'll get the check signed and that's it.
What are we doing here? Like, we know how modern day sports works. We know that everybody has a boss and we know who that boss is directly. We know who hired this guy. We know who instilled a lot of the cultural issues that we see as a problem here. But even still, it's pretty obvious that you need a different voice in the room. You need a different voice that's outward facing to the fans. And at this point, you just want to feel as though they're taking that seriously. And so for the cheap pop part of this, yeah, fire the guy. Let people feel as though there isn't that scary thing that's hanging over them. Right. The idea that teams don't know what they're dealing with or who they're dealing with, that better be clear. That better be clear around baseball. It better not be Atkins has any type of leverage in terms of keeping his job with some type of awesome trade. Like, that's done. You had your time here. You failed. I think that some of it is overstated, some of it is understated. Like the farm system that finally people are catching up to, going, wait, why is it that Aurelvis Martinez goes away and that's the end of the guys?
Yeah, 8 years in, you're still in the 20s
that's
for
it.
Farm system
so
rank.
I just think that having the, well, this person's a shield and this is about now optics and giving the new regime a fresh start, like that's not modern day sports fandom. That is a fundamental misunderstanding of your fan base and where they're at in general. So just take the layup. Sometimes it's okay to just lay the ball in.
They're trying to Bebe Noguera kick the layup out
for
three.
Lay it in the basket, for God's sakes. Like, don't kick it over the net. Just tap it in. Just tap it in.
Yeah, and that, look, you're right. From a modern fan base perspective, and whether they like it or not, PR is a part of that job, right? Mm-hmm. Like, part of that, yes, it's about the baseball decisions and stuff like that, but it is also you are the person who's talking to the fan base every so often.
They're still coming down.
Yeah.
Like I said,
although attendance is down 3,000 or 4,000 per game so far over this point last year. Which
really?
Yeah.
That's surprising because I feel like every game I've gone to has been, and I've been to many.
I think.
I know you go a lot too. You go more in the journalist.
No, I go pregame and do the media stuff, okay. And then I go drink a beer in the seats.
So I was gonna say I think if I showed up in the media box, people would be like, "What are you giving someone a tour?
Yeah. Yes, are someone, you just here for a bobblehead?
Yeah, exactly. Why are you here? I'm always in the stands, and I find it's just rammed usually.
Yeah, and like the Red Sox was a really good crowd and stuff like that.
I was there for the Wednesday game against the Red Sox. Went around again the stadium, which is nice.
Yeah,
that's part of it.
If you had a good baseball team, it's a really good place to watch a ball game.
I think that that's the other part of it, too, is, hey, you know, you can sell. People like going to the ballpark. Mm-hmm. People enjoy having a beer in the sun and walking around with their friends. And
so here's my other big picture question for you then.
Yeah.
You have 40,000 seats that you want to sell. You have an engaged fan base, even when the team is not that great.
Yeah.
You have one more year of Bo and Vlad before their free agency.
Yeah.
Where do you land on this? And I think my reading of the tea leaves, talking to Ben Nicholson Smith and Shai and stuff like that, is they're not going to do the full teardown. It would be a sell the free agents, sell guys who have more value now than they will later, and try to contend again in 2025. You're not going to get to the Yankees Orioles level of contention with a quick retool like that, not with the, you know, how much money you have committed already and who's a free agent and stuff like that, short of getting Juan Soto, which I'm not going to bite on that pump fake again. But the idea of it's going to be a sell, but with an eye toward 2025 instead of an eye toward like 2027. How do you feel about that side?
So there's so many playoff teams now that you can always be competitive, right? Like you should be able to be competitive next
Bad
year.
Bad teams make the playoffs.
What I really do strongly believe, though, is that there is a miscalculation right now about the value of trying to put out the quote-unquote winner. Like the at all costs, well, maybe we're going to keep Vladdy and Bo both for one more run because we can sell some pieces and then we'll pivot and we'll try to win next year. It's pretty clear that 2015 and 2016 had a material impact on the way people view this franchise and enjoy going to and investing in being Blue Jays fans. And I think that what has happened now that we haven't seen in a while is a level of anger that is not comparable in the Twitter / social media era, right? Like, I can't speak to what it's been like in some of the down seasons for the Blue Jays that, you know, I either wasn't a fan of or I wasn't a part of as a media member. But in terms of fan disengagement, I feel that more so now than ever. Like that there are just people who are, and a lot of times sports fans threaten it where they're like, I'm not coming back. And then the team wins and then they're like, oh, so they just, you know, fade back. They're the Homer Simpson fading back into the bush. People are pissed. People feel like their voices aren't heard. They feel like disrespected by the organization in a way where it's like, they've been saying obvious things year over year, like, hey, don't bring back the general manager that we can't stand, who seems to be like, I'm the smartest guy in the room and nothing's working out.
Dude, a listener told me I sound like Ross Atkins the other day and I died inside.
Yeah, it's like, that's an insult. Yeah. Like, so I think people right now don't feel heard. And so the idea that you would bring back this essentially same core and go, don't worry, we've changed the pieces around it, I don't think it's going to work for a lot of people. I think that there's got to be a little bit of a baseball and business decision that is made, which is you got to make a pretty major pivot here. You can't just trot back out Kevin Gausman, Bo Bichette, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and then the new Justin Turner and the new, you know, free agent signing that's a middle of the pack guy because you missed and you swung and missed on the top tier dudes. To me, I think the time is now to be making a trade for one of those guys. You're getting 1.5 seasons. I'd prefer they keep Vladdy. I'd prefer they re-sign Vladimir Guerrero Jr. But if someone comes over the top rope, another wrestling, wrestling stuff for you today, with just a massive Godfather deal, I kind of think this is where you've got to do it. If Bo Bichette is having a down season and everyone's worried about what his value is going to be, what his value is going to be higher in the offseason, why would it be that?
I mean, like, I guess it would. The argument would be he steers out of it, the final season line. But then you only get one season of Bo Bichette instead of a playoff run with Bo Bichette and a whole other season.
Correct. And who doesn't think that Bo Bichette is going to normalize to a certain degree as he does every single season? Like, if there was ever an asset that a team was buying that you felt comfortable going, oh, we don't think that there's been a massive negative regression, it's the guy who's a up-and-down hitter who all of a sudden ends up getting some lineup protection and is in a happier situation because, God knows, it's got to be miserable being the guy who year over year says, this has got to be our year where we mature. I think that this is now the time where they should be moving off of one of those pieces. I think they should be firing a member of the front office. And I think that they need to show fans that there's a steady hand on the wheel and that they're not just paying attention to trying to make the baseball team better and to build a sustainable winner, but that they hear how upset people are and how desperately this franchise needs a new look, just like the stadium needed a new look.
Yeah, and people will support it if those moves get made. That's it. I think the most important part there is the more you tilt toward it's a more aggressive long-term rebuild, Bo's on the table, Vlad's on the table, Gausman or whoever's on the table.
Everybody should be on the table.
But the more you move toward that, the more, even more strongly I feel, and I already feel this way, that the person who got you into this mess should not be the one making the moves to
get
you out of it.
But the thing that I think scares me is in sports right now, there's a little bit of, we're paralyzed with making analysis about change. Because you've been painted into a corner where you sound dumb giving up on talent, right? Where you go, well, what are you going to do? You're going to get back prospects for Vladdy? What are you going to do? You're going to trade talent? You're going to give up on Bo? Like, you could win next year. Why wouldn't you want to keep good players? It's, again, the same thing with Marner. It was the same thing with OG and Siakam. Like, why would you want to give up on talent? It's because eventually they might leave you. And having rental players or having guys that leave you on through free agency is fine if they've accomplished things. But to go through this entire era where you lose this many
Lowry and Kawhi and Danny Green and stuff like that after a championship, it's a little
different
than like, they walked at the end of an era where, we made a couple wild card games and didn't win a playoff.
Well, especially when we realize more and more that, hey, you know, athletes here, they have pretty, especially when we're talking about the Raptors and the Blue Jays, and you're trying to bring players up from America. It is a different country. I'm sorry. It feels more disconnected and difficult for a lot of these families. You have a change in lifestyle. You've got higher taxation than just about like anywhere in the United States. Like, it's not as attractive as we try to bill it because of the size of the city or the fact that it's a, you know, major metropolis here.
Go plot recent NHL playoff success by the state's tax, income tax.
Exactly. And so I don't understand the idea of, well, you know, we'll just be able to rebuild and we'll be able to spend money. It's like, no, you need to here in this market, you need to be more cautious with the players that you have, the assets that you have. You can't just decide to let own rentals walk on the baseball team. You can't afford to just get killed in a Pascal Siakam trade because it is going to set you back further than some of the other organizations in the sport. So, I do think that the time to make a change is now, even though, again, it can always circle back to, well, why would you give up on talent?
Yeah. Okay. So let's use that as a pivot to the Raptors, because I did want to do like 10 minutes on the NBA draft from last night. So look, there is the trades certainly look how they look. OG Anunoby's now getting $42.5 million. You probably didn't want to pay that. Getting IQ and RJ is maybe a decent haul for that. But you look and you know, it's a draft where you don't have your own pick because of the Jakob Poeltl trade.
It was weird picking behind like the Sixers and the Lakers.
After a non-playoff year, and then, of course, you know, we see the Mikal Bridges haul, and the leverage in that situation is a little different and everything, but you get significantly more for Mikal Bridges than you got for Pascal Siakam, and we can go through all that. And then the Raptors select Jacoby Walter at number 19. You and I were texting through all this, so this is stuff we've talked about already a little bit, but what do you make of the pick? How'd you feel about the first round of the draft generally?
I actually really like the pick from this standpoint. You're at 19 in a draft where there's a lot of we don't knows, and you took a kid who can clearly shoot and who has 6'10" wingspan at 6'4".
Yeah.
And last time I checked, you know, what never goes out of style in the NBA is shooting and wingspan. Yeah. So you grabbed two things with this guy. I will say his reaction when he got drafted wasn't the most...
I think he was trying not to cry.
Okay.
Is the way that I...
But for what reason was he trying not to cry?
I mean, he's in
purple.
He's
a Texas kid. I know, but... He didn't work out for the Raptors. It did seem
So, by the way, he didn't work out for the Raptors because, in part because, like, when you have the picks number 19 and 31 and a guy's draft range is expected to be a lottery, it's hard to get that guy in. The Raptors, I don't know that the Raptors, I think Edie was the only one who went in the top 10 who they worked out.
Okay. Either way, I didn't think that he looked particularly thrilled. My only thing is Baylor, though, does always remind me, sometimes I do think of the school when we're looking at stuff like this, and I'm like, who's ever really come out of Baylor that like really exceeds expectations? Like I feel like Baylor is always a school where there's a ton of like really good athletes. They've usually had like Brady Heslop went there, good shooter. Yeah. But they list the
couple Raptors legends, Ish Wainwright, Freddie Gillespie.
Yeah, it's not a school that usually hits and exceeds expectations. But either way, again, good wingspan, good shooter. Someone who, whenever I watched Baylor games, always stuck out as, oh, well, there's the guy that's going to go to the NBA. Yeah. So that's something. I think that when they call him a 3-and-D guy, that's probably a little overstated as of right now. And even he has admitted that he needs to get stronger because there's real questions about his ability to like finish inside and take contact, even though he does go to the free throw line. So yeah, he's a bit of a work in progress, but in terms of like where the Raptors are at, and what they've got moving forward, I like the idea of them playing it with some upside, but also a little bit more safety in the upside rather than just going out there and taking like a complete lottery ticket player. I didn't like the idea of them going out and get one of the like defense only players like Ryan Dunn, where it was
not
like,
at 19.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I think that they ended up with pretty good value. It's not to me like I'm blown away. I'm extremely excited. I'm not renewing season tickets over getting Jacoby Walter, but I think that there's a lot of reason to be more optimistic anyways than pessimistic about the pick. So I think it's a pretty good job.
Yeah,
it's like a best player available thing is what I think they took.
Yeah, short of Jared McCain slipping to 19, I don't know that you were going to be super excited.
I wanted Topic, but I texted you the second that the Thunder were up for a pick. I was like, this is a Presti all over, and he's going to take him. And yes, of course they did.
Yeah, a million picks still, and now they get Topic Thunder, as I saw people joking. I know that's not how you pronounce it, but it's a good Twitter joke still.
What do you want them to do today?
The Raptors?
Yeah.
I mean, I can go a couple different ways with
it. But you wanted to take Bronny. That's the only question.
At 31. Like, if they trade down, like, he's not a 31-level prospect. Like,
sure.
Like, I get it. You troll LeBron, eyes on your program and stuff like that.
No, it's the opposite. It's that you trade for him, and then you get a piece back from whoever LeBron is.
Oh, well, I mean, I think... This is fascinating with it being the first year that it's a 2-day draft.
Yeah.
Like they'll have had like 16 hours to sit there and take
field
trade offers.
Yeah.
The Knicks got 6 second round picks for the number 24 pick.
Yeah.
I'm not advocating for 6 second round picks
as a whole. If you can get 6 second round picks for the pick they have today, get them. Take them.
Yeah, I would say as long as one of those picks is later in this round. I don't want to come away from today with no extra prospects when you're rebuilding I don't know. Give me some guy to throw on a two-way or the 905 or something
that. See, this is selfish. You want this for selfish reasons. Because you watch all the 905 games, and so you want to have somebody else that's on the 905 that you can tweet about, and people won't reply, who cares?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I don't know. Adem Bona or someone like that. Sure. Jonathan Mogbo, come on down. Someone who's going to need some 905 time.
Well, Bronny's already said he's not playing for the 905. He won't sign a two-way contract. So that's out the... You definitely don't want him.
Yeah. I mean, you could still assign a guy. Like, he doesn't... You sign him to a regular contract and assign him to the G League.
I don't think he's going to
play. He needs the G League time.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to do it.
Yeah, well...
I think he's going to sit on the bench in the NBA next to his papa.
Yeah,
I think
that he's going to go Thanasis mode instead of
My only thing with the whole Lakers idea is, what do the Lakers have to trade for him at this point? Like, you want... what was the guy they drafted last year that didn't play for them?
Max Christie? No. Jalen Hood-Scavino?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. You want him? Because that's what the ideal scenario is you get him? What's his name? Hood-Scavino?
Hood-Scavino?
Hood-Scavino, yeah. Hey.
There are a couple names, and like, it's a weird one where, like, I think Johnny Furphy's probably the best player left on the board.
That everyone knows. What a name, though. Furphy.
Yeah. You got to say Johnny Furphy like Dave Chappelle saying Charlie Murphy.
Yeah, but
it's just the only way to say it.
No, but it just sounds so made up. It's like, what's your name? You're like, Johnny Furphy. And they're like, what was that? Johnny Furphy.
It's like the Mariners had that reliever, Penn Murphy.
Yeah.
I'm like, are we just, I couldn't think of a fake name.
Yeah.
So I just saw something on the table. Like. I'm like, Penn.
Yeah.
Penn is my name.
Yeah,
Penn.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Outside of the Raptors, we got like 4 or 5 minutes here. Yeah. What did you think of... So the Spurs, obviously, they make the one pick. They get Castle, who's a really nice fit with Wemby. But then they have another potential pick, and they decide to trade it. And the idea there being, well, we've got young guys already. 2031, we're going to be, you know, these guys are going to be on their next contracts. We could use an unprotected first to add to this. Meanwhile, the Wolves are like, no, we got a contention window right now. Like, we'll trade whatever to add another dynamic young player into this. What'd you like or dislike about that swap, Dillingham?
I hated it. I think that's kind of the consensus thing. I'd love to zag on this take and go like, no, this is how you do business. I don't think that the Spurs, people will go, well, they're punting for another year and they want to draft high again and have Wemby with another co-star. I go, you think that Dillingham was going to really materially change the ceiling of the team? Like, you were going to win, what, 7 more games because Dillingham's coming off your bench? No. You got a guy that I thought really fit with what the Spurs are doing. Is a guy who's going to be a bit of a defensive liability, but was a good isolation scorer and could create for others. And if I was Wemby, I'd love to play with a guy like that. I'd be going, hey, it's great when I'm playing defense that Castle's going to guard the other guy, but I'm around the basket. I'm going to swat everybody and everything.
Blocks.
Yeah, like I'll be fine on the defensive end. And great, I like the Castle pick too, and I think that probably more likely than not, we're looking at this signing. We're back to just feeling as though the Spurs do things correctly and that they got the guy in the draft. I know I felt that way when they walked in.
Which is why it's a little hard to look at the trade and be like, the Spurs are nailing everything else. What am I missing here?
Right.
And I know there's some element of like cap management and push a cheap contract down the line and stuff like that. But it does
seem
a lottery pick when you're building around Wemby in year two is a tough one to make heads or tails.
So I want to see Wemby with another guy who can handle the ball, create for himself, who we can play with in the pick and roll, who can hit a shot. Like I would have just much rather seen that.
You're done with point Jeremy Sohan?
Yeah, I am. And the other thing with the pick, does Anthony Edwards strike you as the kind of guy who's going to be demanding a trade? And I know it's hard to project 6 years down the line, but does he feel like the kind of guy who is going to go join a super team somewhere? Or does he seem more like the kind of guy who wants to be new Kobe and play for the one franchise?
I mean, probably more the latter.
Yeah.
But you still need, like, they needed a little extra bench juice this past year. And
No, I mean it from the standpoint of when that pick is conveyed to the Spurs. Like, when you're talking about even
sorry, I thought
buying,
you were saying because Dillingham's, like, maybe a little skill redundant.
No. I love the trade for Minnesota.
Okay.
Go out and get, again, you
okay,
know what?
Great.
I would talk about, hey, shooting and wingspan doesn't go to style. You know what else doesn't? Being able to create for yourself in isolation like Dillingham can. Being
buckets.
A Kentucky point guard who can score on your own and not need help from anybody, that's probably going to work out fine. Maybe he's not going to the Hall of Fame, but my guess is that he's going to be able to score 15 points a game in the league, like, pretty seamlessly with some regular rotation minutes. So I love it from the Timberwolves standpoint. I just don't understand why you're trading for picks when Anthony Edwards is going to be 28 and 29 years old on the Timberwolves. Like, what is going to lead you to believe that, A, he's leaving, or that those are going to be some kind of valuable picks? I get it when you're buying a team that's all in right now that doesn't look like they're going to be great in the future. I would actually advocate buying Minnesota any other time because guys generally don't want to be there. But they've got the one guy who...
And maybe, like, top three front office guy in Tim Connelly? Like built the Nuggets, then built the Wolves?
That's what I mean. I just don't get the deal with that team. Like, I'd want to be doing that if you were trading for the, you know, Atlanta Hawks future first round pick. You go, oh, there's probably a good chance that this gets screwed up now. Like, what is the future of their team? What could they ever end up accumulating?
That Suns pick that Houston just reacquired.
Right, like those teams where you have a little bit more of a murky future, but you're trading for two picks. Well, one that you get, one pick swap, but right in the heart of Anthony Edwards' post-prime. So that part of it I didn't like either. I love what Houston did, though. I thought that my major takeaway was going to be that the Texas teams nailed it. Because now if you look at Houston, they've got great vets, like winner vets, guys who care, a winning head coach. They've got clear toughness. And now they've got a handful of like really interesting young guys that are either going to be super attractive in a trade if you want to try to piece something together for like a star of the Kevin Durant caliber. When I thought that was even part of the reason why his name was in trade rumors is when you go look at the likely destinations of guys, you say, well, why wouldn't they be a Kevin Durant team?
Right.
I think that that would be a rush for them. I would want to sort of see how this thing plays out. But if you were doing the like, hey, what teams are building the right way draft? What teams are emulating the new Boston Celtics model of having five really effective starters? Obviously, OKC would be the pick. But I think that the Rockets did a very nice job of kind of joining that secondary tier down from the Thunder of, hey, the next sort of teams to watch in the NBA.
Yeah, and we know that market will be super aggressive chasing, whether it's KD or, ideally tax, someone a few years younger that you could pair with that. All right, man, I'm going to let you go. You already did your own show
and this one.
Thanks for taking the time out. And, we'll text a little more about pick number 31. We'll get really, really mad or really, really happy about a guy
who
we'll see at Paramount Fine Food Center.
I don't care.
All right. J.D. Bunkus of the J.D. Bunkus podcast. Make sure you're subscribed over there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Steph Apstein from Sports Illustrated. We'll talk to Dan Zaborski from Fangraphs as well. And we'll sprinkle in a little bit more NBA draft stuff as well, since the Jays got rained out last night. That's everything as Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. No Jays game last night, or rather it was just a couple innings before they got washed away by serious rain. And I learned a weather term. I saw one of the meteorologists in Boston saying the rain was coming in hot dog formation, which I didn't realize was a thing, but I looked at the little Doppler thing and apparently that meant that the game was going to get rained out. It never looked like it was coming back. So August 26th, the Jays will make that up as part of a split doubleheader. They'll do that one in the afternoon, the final seven innings and change of that one. And then they'll play the Red Sox as part of that series. The Jays have to turn the page to the Yankees tonight. So let's go down to someone who's written about the Yankees a fair amount recently and the return of Gerrit Cole and some candle stuff from the clubhouse. It's Stephanie Apstein of Sports Illustrated. Steph, how are you? Thank you for doing this.
I'm good. Thanks for having me. Yeah, you nailed all of my highlights, I think.
Not all of them, because I did want to ask you. I know it's a couple weeks away still, and I know it's not exactly baseball related, but I know you're doing some Olympic stuff as well. How excited are you for Olympic season?
Extremely. I'm really excited. I can't wait.
Are you going?
I am.
Awesome.
Yeah, I leave in about a month.
That's awesome. Do you have like a top three events you're hoping to like for me, it'd be like, I want the street skateboarding. I want the Olympic style wrestling. And then obviously the basketball. But I realize basketball is like outside of Paris. So it's maybe a little tougher. What's front of mind for you? Which ones are you trying to get in?
Well, I'll definitely be doing gymnastics for us, but then in between, I really want to see breaking. I think that is going to be really cool. Skateboarding, I got to see in Tokyo, and that was awesome. That was really fun, especially because they're all like 13.
Yeah.
And so that feels wild. I'd like to see sport climbing too. I didn't get to see that in Tokyo. I forget what I was doing, something else. And I really like to see that. That seems like a very serious.
Well, that'll be fun. I look forward to hearing about that and seeing the coverage from that. Let's talk Yankees. The Yankees are here for four in Toronto. Things are obviously going a lot better for them than they are for the Toronto Blue Jays right now. I guess first, just at a high level, this Yankees team has dealt with so many injuries, and we thought maybe the rotation would be a little thin coming into the year. You know, they've got Stanton and Rizzo on the IL right now, and I know it hasn't been like the sharpest week or so, but generally they're still near the top of the AL. They're the top of the AL East. What do you make of this Yankees team and their ability to kind of withstand some of those holes, you know, people thought might get poked in them in the first half here?
Yeah, I think the team is probably still a little bit top heavy, which you see every time, you know, Judge sits out or something, and it's basically just Soto in there. But for the most part, I think that they have been remarkably resilient. Actually, I think when you lose the best pitcher in the sport for, you know, the first 3 months of the season and still are as good as this team has been, that's pretty remarkable. I think Luis Gil had a tough night last night, but has been really kind of a revelation. Carlos Rodon has been a lot better this year. Stroman has been pretty strong. Clark Schmidt before he went down was good. Everybody has sort of been able to maintain, which has been important. I think you're starting to see that get harder for the lineup. They're starting to take on a little bit of water there. With Rizzo, I mean, Rizzo wasn't playing well. LeMahieu has been struggling. They, especially with Stanton hurt now, they've basically got two reliable hitters. And I think teams are starting to react that way, starting to sort of understand that you don't really have to those two guys. But that will be, I think, the question for the team the rest of the way. Can someone else emerge as the sort of protection for those two guys?
And because they're the Yankees, they'll always be active ahead of the trade deadline, maybe looking to supplement that, of course. You mentioned they've gotten this far with, until the last two starts, without the arguably the best pitcher in baseball in Gerrit Cole. He won Cy Young last year. The Jays gave him a big assist with that because he faced them a whole bunch down the stretch and just dominated them. We'll see him on Sunday. Only two starts back, and obviously one was short and one didn't go all that well. But where does he look, or what does he look like, rather, in terms of, you know, those steps back to getting back to being Gerrit Cole right now?
I think he believes he's healthy. He thinks that the stuff that he lacked command the last time out, but that's fixable. The velocity numbers were bad and everybody freaked out. And he said, no, he had purposely taken some off to try to improve his command, which didn't really work. But he seems to think that this was a speed bump, not a disaster. They don't like to tell you the exact pitch count, because that, yeah, as he said when he was asked last time, that's a competitive disadvantage, you know. But I think he's getting close to being ready to go for full, you know, six, seven innings. And I think the idea is that he'll be back to full strength now, or close to it.
Well, we'll see on Sunday just how far he can go. The Jays have not been the best offense in baseball at chasing pitchers early, so we'll see. Look, the Yankees lost 6 of 7, including 2 to the Mets, even though, like we're talking about, they've been very, very good overall. How nice has it been with this Mets team turning it around? Like, the Subway Series was really, really fun. How fun was that for you?
Yeah, that was really fun. It's fun when both of those teams are good. And I think even people who hate those teams, like, you know, even other AL East fans, other NL East fans, probably if pressed would admit that it's more fun if these two sort of monsters are good, especially because their hope is that their team would then beat a good Yankees. It's more fun to beat a good Yankees team than a bad Yankees team. I just think it's good for the sport. Those are, you know, teams to draw eyeballs, and they're teams that are, they have a lot of stars. And so it's fun to see them play well. And then it's fun for opposing fans to see them fail in the end.
I certainly feel that way here. Feel that way about the Red Sox as well. So
for sure.
Off the field, you wrote this great piece the other week about how the Yankees have been like, you know what? Everyone's lighting candles at their lockers. Aaron Boone's kids are in there talking about how nice it smells. I guess my first question is, how many candles do you think they could get across the border at once without raising some red flags? If you could just kind of take us inside that Yankees locker room a little bit.
Yeah, I think that was an issue for the Twins.
With the salami.
Rally sausage or whatever, yeah. So this one, I think, fortunately, the Yankees have chosen a non-food item. There was some talk when I was in there, they were going through a box of candles that Clark's mother sent them, and some of them they felt were too big to take on the road with them. So they had to make sure to use those in the home clubhouse, and they were going to collect the smaller ones and bring them with them to the road towns. I did not see any in their visiting clubhouse at Citi Field. Hmm. Although perhaps that, since that's not really a road city, they don't really pack for that. Maybe that's why. I did look and I was a little disappointed. But yeah, I was surprised. I walked in there a couple of weeks ago and I was like, why doesn't it smell like socks in here? It smells great. And it turns out it was because the Yankees, Marcus Stroman is a big candle guy. He has been doing it for years. It makes him, he likes him a lot at home, and it makes him feel sort of calm and relaxed at the field if he brings that part of home with him. And he was pitching really well. And so the Yankees were like, maybe it's the candles. And they're all into candles now. They got Volpe into it. It was just the starters, but now they got the shortstop wanted a Christmas candle. So I think it's a pretty loose group. They're having a pretty good time. Until the last few, they had been playing really well. And even with the last few, I think they understand this is a really good team. And so it makes it a lot easier to have these quirky traditions when you're winning almost every night.
Yeah, and that's, it's always like, in retrospect, it can be a chicken or the egg thing. Were they winning because they were really loose and they had celebration salami or the candles or whatever? Or were they winning so they got to be loose and do all that stuff? It's a tough chicken
for
or
sure.
egg. And you mentioned, so the Yankees have dropped 6 of 7, but they're still very good. They know they're a very good team. If there's a note off of that, it's that the Orioles are back within a game of them now. And this is going to be a really tight American League East race. I know that's an Orioles team that you wrote about a little tongue-in-cheek the other day because all the prospects they keep calling up look alike. But that's also just a very, very good Orioles team. How worried do you think those Yankees are or should be about that second half AL East race?
I think the question for the Orioles is going to be what they do at the deadline. I think that the pitching is a little light. That's not entirely the front office's fault. I mean, when you have 4 starting pitchers go down in the first half, that's hard for any team to come back from. But that Orioles team has built through on the position player side. They've drafted, they've signed some international guys. That's sort of been their strategy, is let's build and let's grow the pitchers and the hitters and try to go buy the hits. And they have grown the hitters, and so now it's time to go buy the pitchers. And that will be the question. At least for me. Hopefully some of these guys start to come back, and that makes it a lot easier. But this is sort of the moment. Like, this is the window. This team is really good. Do you want to add? They certainly have the prospect capital. And so I think we will know a lot more about this team on August 1st.
And yeah, we'll see this army of prospects that look alike, if they can pull from those. And if they, I mean, it's even a case, there was a trade in the NBA a couple years ago where all that we got in the report was Brooks, and we didn't know which Brooks, and then it ended up being the bad Brooks was in the trade. I feel like the Orioles could do that, but visually, they just like send a pic, like
sure.
a headshot of who they're trading, and a team thinks they're getting like Gunnar Henderson, and it's, I don't know, Heston Kerstad or something instead. Okay, with how the Orioles have built this, how much, I don't know how much you get a sense of, you know, being a national reporter when things are going bad for teams. So if the Jays, for example, you know, I'll get, and this isn't every fan, but some fans want the Jays to, you know, blow it up entirely. You should tank for a couple of years, look at the Orioles. But Major League Baseball has changed the rules basically to prevent an Orioles style tank and rebuild. What do you, I guess, make of the fact that the Orioles have been able to pull this off? And it's like, obviously the best possible outcome of tanking like that, but that Major League Baseball saw this and was like, hey, we can't, even in a sport where we're okay with Oakland existing and the White Sox existing, stuff like that, you can't do it to this degree. It's not cool.
Yeah, I think this is so easy to say, right? Either way, but a better team to look at for a sort of a team that wants to rebuild would be the Rays. They tend to do a really good job, I think, of retooling on the fly, where they will trade at the deadline. They'll trade at the starting pitcher. Everybody will say, how on earth did you see? You know, you see them so close to the East. What's the matter with them? And then they get back a couple of really good hitters, or they get back somebody, and all of a sudden they make the playoffs. And so I think that they're always trading for sort of years of control. And I think that might be a smart move. I think I can understand fans saying this Blue Jay season is over. Why are we still watching these players? Like, let's try this again. I do think that the Orioles rebuild is unusually successful. Like, the Tigers also were bad for a while. And the Tigers are not that good. They're better, but the Tigers are not the Orioles. You mentioned the White Sox, the A's. Now, the A's certainly are not a team that is trying to win. The White Sox, I think, are trying to win. But it doesn't always work. Like the Reds also bottomed out a little bit. Most teams are not the Astros, the Cubs, the Orioles. In fact, those are pretty much the only three who have been able to make it work. So I think that it is reasonable for the Blue Jays team to start thinking about which of these guys are going to be part of our future, which of these guys do we think we can re-sign. But I think a wholesale teardown is maybe not as successful as is not as guaranteed to be successful as fans imagine.
Yeah, and you better be real good picking in the like early teens or 7, 8, 9 range, because you can't pick in the top six year over year anymore, even if you do bottom out. Stephanie, last one for you before I let you go. You tweeted this. So at the Rickwood Field game last week, there was a celebrity game, and at part of that softball game, you had to make catches, you know, Willie Mays style. And you said, "Hey, this is something I'd like to see in All-Star Weekend." I've kind of been asking a bunch of people, what event would you actually like to see added to, you know, let's say as part of Home Run Derby night, there's just something else, you know, whether it's speed, defense, a basket catch, thing like that. Do you have any ideas to kind of add the Home Run Derby is the main event, of course, but like something to whet our appetite on the way there?
Yeah, I think, Derek Jeter turns 50 this year. I think maybe it would be cool if we could see the jump throw, if everybody could try to recreate that, or maybe the flip play even better, which would get everybody back there. I think that the Home Run Derby is really cool. I think they do a great job with that. It's gotten even better over the years. But I do think that this is sort of a missing, this is an opportunity. That people really like to see those cool defensive plays. And it also would allow you to honor players who don't hit a lot of home runs or who are not otherwise sort of important to what those festivities do, but who fans really like to watch. I think it would be cool if they tried, you know, I'd be interested in a, in like an accuracy of throw competition. I think there's a lot of stuff that goes into being a good baseball team that I'd like to see.
I think I would also like an accuracy of hit. Like we could have Stephen Kwan against Luis Arraez having to hit little like targets around the outfield. And like,
that
I don't know, if
awesome.
You get it right in the center, it's 100 points. The outer ring's 50 or whatever. And just see how
accurate. Yeah, it's like top
golf. Yeah, exactly. But with hitting. Steph, I said that would be the last question. I do have one more for you. If I were looking to read a terrific book about Clayton Kershaw, are there any that you could recommend for us?
You know, there is. I actually almost wore my Last of His Kind t-shirt. But yeah, I highly recommend by Andy McCullough, The Last of His Kind, Clayton Kershaw and the Burden of Greatness. It's a book about baseball. It's a book about fatherhood. It's a book about adapting when your industry shifts under your feet. I think I think no one who reads it would possibly be disappointed. He did a really good job.
And we've had Andy on the show to discuss it. A friend was actually texting me on the weekend. He just finished it about how much he liked it. So glad everyone's enjoying that so much. Steph, thanks so much for taking the time out. If we don't talk to you, have a great time at the Olympics too.
Thank you. Thanks.
Stephanie Apstein of Sports Illustrated. And yeah, that book is The Last of His Kind, Clayton Kershaw and the Burden of Greatness by Andy McCullough, who we have talked to and talked about that book as well. So the Jays didn't play last night, but we have a couple of small updates for you. I mentioned Yariel Rodriguez got a couple side innings in so that he can stay stretched out. Of course, he only went one inning and change in his first start back. He threw a lot of pitches, but you want to make sure that he's stretched out with, you know, up downs, as they call them, simulated innings. So he was able to get in three innings through simulation. And John Schneider said they'll keep him on that same trajectory for his next start. So whether that means three or four, whatever, Monday figures to be his next start, leading either a start or leading a bullpen day, however you want to phrase it for a guy who's going to go three or four innings. But that would be the Canada Day game against the Houston Astros. Bowden Francis did a side session Tuesday. So he's obviously, we would have expected him to be the bulk follower to Yariel Rodriguez yesterday. He's available out of the bullpen throughout this Yankees series. They're not going to sit him down for 4 days just in case you need him behind Yariel. So whether that's long outing, whether that's a short outing, he will be available throughout this series. They were hoping Dalton Varsho was going to be back yesterday or maybe today. They're hoping to avoid an IL stint. He obviously wasn't in the lineup yesterday, but we'll see when that lineup comes out. Tonight, Ricky Tiedemann threw his third rehab outing yesterday, threw 2 1/3 innings, didn't allow a hit, 2 walks, 5 strikeouts. So again, the command once in a while spotty there, but the swing and miss stuff, the strikeout stuff is obviously really there. On a less good note, Eric Swanson continues to get rocked at AAA. John Schneider said they're basically trying everything they can to try to get him back. And even though the shape of the fastball and the splitter look good, he's like the ERA is like 15 or 16 at this point. Joey Votto played yesterday. He went 0-for-3, but he's back into game action here. And then the only other note from this morning's minor league lineups is that Arjun Amala, who was the Jays' first-round pick last year, number 20 overall, he had started the season at Dunedin, got taken out of Dunedin, went to the developmental list, so just working in the complex, then played in a bunch of complex league games. He is back with single-A Dunedin today. He is starting at shortstop in a game that Jerron Watts-Brown is starting on the mound, and I don't think we're going to see Watts-Brown at Dunedin a whole lot more. He has got to be one or two good starts away from the bump to Vancouver. We'll keep an eye on all that stuff, see if Joey Votto's playing a little later. We're going to take a break. On the other side, we'll talk to Dan Zimborski of Fangraphs at the midway mark here as JSOC Plus continues.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to JSOC Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jay's back in action tonight against the Yankees. Carlos Rodon against Jose Berríos. The first of four against the Yankees. The first of eight at home here because the Astros come through next week starting on Canada Day as well. We are going to hit the official halfway mark after Friday's game. That'll put the Jays at 81 on the season, which means it's the easiest day of the year to do math. You just double everyone's stat line, and that means that's what they're on pace for. You got 15 home runs, you're on pace for 30. You got a 700 OPS, you're on pace for 1,400. I think that's how it works. Let's see if Dan Zimborski can correct me. He's the creator of Zips. He's one of our favorite writers over at Fangraphs. Dan, good morning. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
I'm good. Obviously joking a little bit about doubling the stats, but we do need to do a little lesson for New York Mets fans. It seems like people are very mad at you that you said Pete Alonso has 16 home runs, so he's on pace for 32.
Well, actually, this was before the season. Someone said I was reviewing the horrible things people said about me coming into the season and how dare I project Alonso to only hit 34 home runs. Do I even think that's true? Generally speaking, people get very angry about projections. And weirdly, they have more faith in how accurate projections are than me, who does projections.
Yeah, it's an unfair thing to be upset with you about. The system is not subjective. That's the entire point of it. Okay, so Dan, the system also is not subjective about the Toronto Blue Jays and where they stand right now. And the Jays enter play today with their playoff odds down to 4.6% over at Fangraphs. Now, that is not zero, but it's very, very far from 100%. What do you make of where the Blue Jays are at right now? Obviously, a very different spot than either of us subjectively or any projection systems objectively thought the Blue Jays would be in right now.
Well, generally speaking, projections did like the Blue Jays quite a bit better than their current record, because if we double, we can't really technically do it until two more games are played. But if we double the wins, we're talking like 73 now wins per 162. And that's well below where anyone had the Blue Jays at. And of course, since it's been over a half a season of that, or a half season, that's kind of problematic, even though they aren't really that far back in the wild card race, which is a curse and a blessing.
Yeah, the curse and the blessing being, you know, maybe you're a little hesitant to wave the white flag just a little yet. So when you look at this, and this is obviously something we can see in the standings without looking at the projection as well, but what worries you more? Like, and this isn't specific to the Jays. You could ask this about, you know, the Giants or whoever's at the bottom of that National League wild card race on a given day. It's not just the 6.5 back you are, it's that you've got to jump like 5 or 6 or 7 teams to get back into that spot, right? Like, that's as big a problem.
Yeah, that is definitely as big as a problem, and it's something I always try to emphasize to people, because people will be like, we're only 4 games back. Like, yeah, but the whole league is between you and the leader, because the problem is, when you are against one other team, say you're 8 games back, there are a lot of scenarios in which you can play 8 games better than another team, because that other team can collapse. When you're behind, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 teams, that isn't an unlikely scenario. Even if you have less room to make up, they're going to play each other a lot. So there's a lot of 500 ball kind of mixed into it implicitly, because 8 teams aren't going to collapse in front of you. So you do have to play better. But I guess the good news is that none of the teams in front of them have played great baseball. So the Blue Jays still have options, but the question is, will they be aggressive enough to really get back into the race by at the trade deadline? And I'm not sure they will be, so I guess is my opinion.
Yeah, so we'll revisit the will they be in the still be in it at the trade deadline in a second here. But when you look at the fact, so obviously, you know, we talked to you early in the year and the projection systems haven't moved much, right? Like a couple weeks of a team underperforming isn't all that a ton of information. But now, like you said, we're halfway in. And instead of projecting the Blue Jays to when they're 0-0, the system maybe says, hey, they're going to be an 86 win team. When we project forward, it says, hey, they would be an 80 or 81 win team if we played this thing all out. So it's safe to say that, you know, the system has adjusted for the fact that the Blue Jays are not as good as we thought. When you look at some of the individuals that have contributed to this on the Blue Jays side, there is still a little bit of optimism in guys bouncing back. You know, Bo Bichette probably the most notable because he's underperformed to such a degree, and Zip sees him still being a really good hitter the rest of the way. Did that surprise you at all when you see like a 115, 120 OPS plus the rest of the way for Bo Bichette, given how his season's gone? Or is this a case of, hey, a young player with track record, you're not really surprised the model's going to be sticky with believing Bo can turn it around?
I'm not super surprised, simply for the latter reason you say. The fact is, he's not a 37-year-old first baseman with bad knees. It's pretty unusual for a very, very good 26-year-old player to suddenly stop playing baseball very well. Even Carlos Baerga kind of fell off a little slower than that. So I think it's a little too soon to panic about that. But naturally, that expectations do get lowered. Certain players more than others. Like, for instance, I'd be a lot more worried about Springer than I am about Bichette, because if you ask me for scenarios in which Springer is just kind of toast, there are more of those than with Bichette.
There are, and a lot of that has to do with age, and I know that age, how players age and why some players are able to buck it or delay it and why other players aren't is still kind of a big unknown. And Springer was a guy I asked you about pretty early in the season because he had had such a decline last year, and Zips was still reasonably optimistic. He was, you know, an everyday player. This doesn't have to necessarily be Springer. You can use, you know, we could look at the Jose Abreu example. The Astros just ate a bunch of money owed to him because there was just too much evidence. The Jays aren't going to do that. At the most, they'd slide Springer into, you know, less of an everyday role. But when you see guys in their 30s, what are you looking for as kind of warning signs that maybe this is legitimate?
Well, it varies from player to player, but usually when you see a fundamental decline in something that is key to that player hitting or playing defense, that's when you start to worry. When a player who hits a lot of infield singles has a leg injury, or suddenly you look at their sprint speed scores and they disappear, those tend to be pretty worrisome. When a guy who's a power hitter suddenly can't hit a fastball anymore, you say, oh, what about his bat speed? Now, of course, we have bat speed data, which we did it in the past, but those kinds of red flags probably differ a little from player to player. In Springer's case, he's kind of declined in kind of an unexpected way, because the worry when they signed him was how long would he be a credible center fielder? And the idea was, yeah, he's eventually going to have to be a right fielder, but will he still hit well enough to play in right field? And the problem right now with him is that he doesn't play center field, really, and he doesn't really hit well enough to play anywhere if you're looking at this season. So I'd be extremely concerned about that. Now, of course, cliffs are possible, like you call Bo Bichette. For instance, Bo Buffett had a very quick decline from the peak of his powers to the Sarlacc pit.
Yeah, that's I'm not the target audience for that one, but I appreciate you trying to make it work there, Dan. Okay, so the 4.6% playoff odds, 4.6 is 4.6 right now. But like you alluded to, that, you know, the your model and any of us really can only evaluate the team that is on the field right now. There's a good chance that by July 30th, given the way things have gone, that the Blue Jays we see on the field right now are not the same team that is playing out the rest of the season. That 4.6 percentage or 10% or 25% or whatever it is, that's going to matter to a different degree to each team. And we've heard from multiple people over the years that teams have their own internal metrics that look at, you know, their playoff odds and things like that. when you look at it, what is a number to you where you think personally that a team should really start consider selling? Like is a 10% chance enough? Is that I think the Arizona Diamondbacks were like in the high teens in August last year. Where's that cutoff point for your personal comfort level in terms of, hey, this is down the drain. Let's sell and look forward.
5% isn't really a bad rule of thumb, but I think it varies from organization to organization. For instance, if you have an older team that's kind of nearing the end of its run, then you kind of ask, can we win now? And if so, what are the consequences of that? If you need to rebuild, then generally speaking, if it's over anyway, then a higher percentage would still lead me towards rebuilding. Like, let's say the White Sox last year had been a better team and had like a 10% chance at making the playoffs with their kind of falling apart core. I'd be more interested in a team like that doing a fire sale than, say, a younger team. I think things that have a 5% chance of happening do happen. It's the probability that take a guy who hits 30 home runs a season. The odds of them hitting a home run in any given at bat is about, 5%. It's essentially the odds of Vladimir Guerrero hitting a home run in over the course of his career. And no one would be actually like shocked by that. Like, oh my God, he hit a home run. How could that be? These things do happen. They're just not super likely. And I think complicating the fact for the Jays is there are a lot more sellers than buyers. And that means that there are going to be fewer choices to choose from, and they're going to be more expensive. And I think that kind of goes more towards selling than buying when I consider those facts on the ground.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's an interesting way to compare it. A 5% chance is the same as Vlad hitting a home run in any spot, where you look at, say, the Orioles, who have a 97% chance right now, and that's the same odds as Ryan Mountcastle hitting a home run in any at-bat against the Blue Jays. So it's helpful to contextualize that way. You mentioned it. This being a seller's market, and I was going to ask you about that, so I'm glad you mentioned it. But whether this is about the Jays or, some of the other fringier teams, I guess the Tigers, technically, even though we all kind of assume the Tigers would have been sellers, they have slightly better playoff odds than the Jays because the Central's a little weaker. A team like maybe the Cubs as well, that's a few games under but not all the way out. Do you see there being... I know that this is true for a buyer, that there is a first mover advantage because you get the player for an extra month. But do you imagine if one of these fringe teams throws in the towel a little earlier, they might get a little more by acting early?
I think they would, because that's kind of the problem for a buyer at this time of the year, is there just aren't enough teams who have thrown in the towel, because you get a lot more value from a player you have for 3 months than you get for 2 months. And I think that if a team like the A's is smart, they would want to get out while the getting is good. That goes for the White Sox too, but I'm not actually sure that they're smart in any way. So just to be very mean about it.
In fact, I'm quite certain they're not.
I just think that teams should not necessarily look for a certain date of the year to start talking about trades. And they are talking, but I think that you do want to pounce at every opportunity. If you can make that trade in April and convince a team that they're out of it, I think you prefer to make that trade in April than in July if you know you're going to need that.
The AJ Preller method that not enough teams use. So the other cool thing we get to do, and this is, we can all sit there with just looking qualitatively as well and just based on our feel and how a lineup looks, but you can do things, and I'm sure you'll do a bunch of this over the next month, plug and play. Like, hey, what does the projection system look like if you drop Danny Jansen onto the Padres, if you drop Yusei Kikuchi onto the Orioles, and so on throughout the league? Who on the Jays are you looking at if they do become sellers that is of most interest to you?
I think that there are several teams that could use a first base DH type. So Vladimir Guerrero Jr. does look very interesting. It'd be weird to see him in with the Yankees, but given some of their problems with Anthony Rizzo, he might be an actual fit there. I don't know how much the Yankees are willing to pay for Guerrero, and there is a psychological leap you have to take when you're trading someone who's been a part of your team for a long time rather than, say, a secondary talent. Like if someone starts calling for, Connor Falefa, I don't think the Jays are going to have any, psychological attachment to him the same way they would with Guerrero or Bichette Or, you know, even Barrios or Gausman.
Okay, so it's and I'm with you. I think the Vlad and Boateng, and there's also an element of, at least here, we think the Jays would be selling with an eye toward competing again in 2025. So if you're getting anyone from them who's under term, you probably got to send something pretty significant back. I want to zoom outside of the Jays and outside of just the playoff picture right now and just talk about the Zips model in general, because it is the midway point of the season. And as much as those 81 games matter the same as the next 81, it does seem like a reasonable point to kind of reflect on things. So I guess first question would be, how well does the first half of the season project the second half of the season generally?
I mean, it gives a lot of information, but it's kind of interesting the way it works out. People tend to have recency bias when they talk about predicting the future. They weigh events that happened recently far too highly, and it's something you always see generally with the people who are the angriest about the projections, because I had all sorts of people telling me there was no way the Yankees could bounce back after last season because last season was that bad, or a number of other teams, or the Cardinals would be they're not going to come anywhere near 500. But the thing is, those preseason projections include past years as well. And the first half this year only includes information from April, May, and June. Now, that's the most relevant information. But things that happened last year and the year before, and even the year before that, still have relevance when you're predicting the future. Generally speaking, at this point of the season, if all you had to go with was the preseason Zips projections and the first half record, you'd go about 65% Zips, 35% actual record. And it's kind of weird how it works out, because when you have projections before a season and you're projecting the year after, you'd expect Zips or any projection system, really, Steamer, Pocota, or any of them, to do a slightly better job at projecting 2025 record in the 2024 preseason than the actual 2024 standings do, simply because they simply have more information that go into that prediction.
Huh. That's I mean, I was fairly aware of the 2/3 and 1/3 split at the midway point for Zips and actual record, but I didn't realize it was that strong predicting year plus one ahead. That's helpful to know. At this point in the year, or I guess generally, how often are you, or is the model itself, learning and adjusting to say, oh, well, the offensive environment has declined, or hey, this class of player, you know, I don't know, this type of guy, all the Isak Paredes who can pull the ball in the air, for some reason keep overperforming their projections. How quick is it to learn, or how often are you adjusting things on the fly?
Well, Zips is pretty quick to learn when it looks at things like hard hit data and how it relates to home run percentage, things like that. The more a player overperforms or underperforms that over time, the more likely it is to believe that. It's the same with pitchers and batting average on balls in play. The longer a pitcher does it, the more Zips believes it. These are kind of how projection systems or any predictive model will learn from its mistakes. You learn a lot more from being wrong about something than being right about something, even if being wrong about something is kind of frustrating, as other Orioles fans made sure to let me know at every opportunity last season. So over time, Zips will believe that Paredes can outperform his power stats. Tom Glavin, at the end of his career, would get a very different projection than he would at the beginning of his career, because there's a whole career, and Zips says, yeah, he actually can outperform his team defense in a way that most pitchers don't, and would give him additional credit for that. So there's always a constant recalibrating of information, whether you're doing an in-season model, season-to-season model, because projections aren't really set in stone. It's simply the midpoint of an array of a huge amount, universe of possibilities. It's like a hurricane forecast in a way. You know, the hurricane bends one way that the forecasters are unexpected, and that little graphic of the hurricane down the East Coast bends out to sea, or it bends into land, or whatever. Predicting the future is very difficult, and even within a season, fluky things can happen.
Yeah, fluky things can always happen, which is how, I mean, it's part of why our brains don't do all that well with probability, or you know, accepting, hey, the projection said this, but it didn't mean it was 100% certain. It's a tough thing psychologically. Dan, I know that you have said that it's still too new to work it in yet, But what are you looking forward to, or what are you looking for in terms of integrating some of the new bat speed metrics that we have into Zips in the future?
What I'm looking for when I use it, obviously I need a lot more data because you need to see the how the predictions work out and how what leads to what. But what I'm looking for is how well bat speed data introduces information into the equation that we're not capturing in other ways with hard hit, launch angle, things like that. I've been tinkering a little bit with just the in-season bat speed data that we have, and there's actually a very high correlation between, you know, exit velocity, launch angle, barrel rate, and bat speed. That's, of course, not unexpected, but the strength of that relationship is a little unexpected. You can actually, just on half a season of data, I was constructing very simple models that could predict about 80% of a player's bat speed. So the question becomes, what is bat speed bringing? Will bat speed help us be wrong in ways we were otherwise be right, or right in ways we were otherwise wrong without that data? And that's going to take a couple of years to really kind of get a handle on.
Yeah, and it sounds fascinating. And, you know, to our earlier conversation about a Springer or a Jose Abreu, the year-over-year bat speed stuff, I'm fascinated for how it maybe helps us understand aging a little bit better. Last one before I let you go here, Dan. I know you wrote about this at Fangraphs, but Christopher Sanchez, a pitcher for the Phillies, I've been fascinated by this year. I've done some Blue Jay Central stuff on him when the Jays have gone up against him. He signed a six-year, $56.5 million contract extension with the Phillies recently. You called it the best rotation in baseball. What do you like about the Phillies generally? Like how, I mean, I know that the Braves have taken a bit of a step back here injury-wise, and the Phillies' lead in the NL East is pretty significant. There is obviously the Dodgers to worry about, the Yankees, the Orioles, and all those surprise teams. But the Phillies now have the best rotation in baseball locked in for a while here. How confident should Phillies fans be?
They should be pretty ecstatic about that, because not only does it help you get to the playoffs, the front names of a rotation play a heavier role in a playoff result than over the course of the season. So having the best rotation in baseball is not only good for the playoffs, which they're almost certainly going to make, now it also makes them very, very dangerous in the playoffs above their one-loss record. One thing the Phillies have done well, the Braves actually do this well too, is that they always allow players to prove them wrong. A lot of teams would take a guy like Christopher Sanchez and just kind of peg him as a certain kind of guy and assume he's always going to be that guy. The Phillies did not expect him to be a Cy Young candidate at this point of the season. If you went back like to 2023, he was just kind of a scrawny, tall, change-uppy guy who had poor command. And that doesn't usually work out that well, but his changeup really kind of, it just kind of, everything kind of fell into place with it. And all of a sudden the Phillies were allowing his performance to get him a spot in the rotation and to keep a spot in the rotation. They weren't just saying, oh, he's just going to be a journeyman quadruple A guy and who plays for Toledo next year. So that's a good thing that teams do. You should always be in a position in which you allow players to prove you wrong, because that's where you get some of these great deals. Not everyone is just a number one pick. Not everyone is, you know, Adley Rutschman or Jackson Holliday when he plays better, which he will.
Yeah, it's a tough one, and it's nice. I mean, it must be nice to have a pitching success story out of the farm system there, even if it took a little bit of patience. Dan Zaborski of Fangraphs, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning, man.
Always fun. Thanks for having me.
Dan Zaborski of Fangraphs. Make sure you're checking out all their great work. And yes, that's Dan is the creator of Zips, which feeds the playoff odds that we'll often reference on here, although probably not for that much longer, because if things keep going the way they're going for the Blue Jays, the playoff odds will be zero, and it won't be a relevant part of the discussion. But for now, they're hanging around 5%, which means at least for a couple more weeks, we don't know for certain which direction the Blue Jays are going to head. This four set against the Yankees could dictate some of that. The four set against the Astros ahead could dictate some of that. Always good to have an 8-game homestand during the nice parts of the year around a holiday weekend, though, so make sure you get down there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Eric Green of The Athletic and how someone who is very reasonable about the Raptors has gotten year over year unreasonable about the Toronto Blue Jays. Talk a little bit about the NBA draft as well. Then we'll let Eric go, and I will set you up for I almost said Raptors against the Yankees. That would be a mismatch. Blue Jays against the Yankees. Rodon against Barrios, which starts the series off tonight. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That is the old theme song of my podcast with our next guest. It was called Raptors Reasonablest. He is the Blue Jays Unreasonablest, though. It's Eric Green of The Athletic. Eric, good morning, man. How you doing?
How's it going?
Pretty good, man. Nice shirt. A Sami Zayn shirt, friend of the show, who has, by the way, if you didn't hear him talking about it on our show last week, a comedy show at the Danforth next Thursday. You can check out more information about that online. Eric, this is the first ever two-day NBA draft. You would have been at covering the draft fairly late last night. Are you ready for round two?
I am. I mean, because it was just one round, I'd say we talked to a member of the Raptors front office, in this case, general manager Bobby Webster, like maybe 45 minutes earlier than we would have in past years. So that's got me a bit fresher. I was asleep before two. We're ready to go. And the Raptors are on the clock, as they have been, as you pointed out, or they will have been at 4 o'clock for about 16 hours and 45 minutes. So, you know, huge catbird seed. Maybe the biggest, the NBA is focused on the Raptors, maybe in a way they won't be for, you know, the next calendar year. My prediction.
Yeah, that's probably a safe one there. What did you make of, and we're going to do some Jay stuff here, but because you're primarily a Raptors guy, Jacoby Walter at number 19. What do we like about that pick? And then I guess more to the kind of strategic philosophy here, a guy who, yes, was solid last year, can probably come in and play some rotation minutes, but this is another teenage pick. This is another guy who's going to need a little bit of time to reach his potential. What did that signal to you with the Walter pick?
Yeah, so, I mean, what I like about it is it's sort of like, it would have been hard for the Raptors to take somebody who wasn't at a position of need, you know? Like,
right.
Unless they took, like, a 6'9 forward with a few shooting issues who needs the ball in his hands, like, they were pretty much going to have, you know, anybody sort of fits in. And that's what Bobby Webster said after. He's like, we're not at a place in terms of overall talent where we can be picking and choosing. We just got to go for talent accumulation. And I think the best version of Jacoby Walter slides in at your two guard. Maybe he can play, you know, up as a three because of his length defensively. But he has a great shooting motion. He's supposed to be, in terms of his shooting, a lot better than the 34% from three he shot last year. The Raptors sort of hinted that a knee issue might have played a part with his relative inefficiency. So I think he's a guy, and he talked about how in high school he was a lot more of an on-ball threat. So I think it's a bit of an upside play in that sense, that maybe he's a lot more than he showed with a Baylor team that had experienced guards running the show. Beyond that, you know, just as for the third time in 4 years, when you go to Scotty Barnes, Grady Dick, and now Jacoby Walter, they've taken a teenager. And, you know, the Raptors are sort of in this place where Barnes, Barrett, Quickly, those are not quite young veterans in the way that we talked about OG Anunoby and Pascal Siakam for all those years, but they're, you know, getting into their early prime, maybe, or they're approaching it. And so you could talk yourself into drafting a more experienced player. And I think they're saying, no, we're going to just take the most talented guy on the board. We're not going to stress if we're, you know, 12th or 13th in the East again, if that's what happens. I don't think it's a move like the Washington Wizards made, where they're like, we don't care about winning at all. We're just accumulating picks and we want to be actively bad next year. But if this guy doesn't have, you know, the year that, let's say, Tristan Da Silva, the senior from Colorado who went to pick earlier, did, I don't think the Raptors are going to be panicking about it. So I think they're sort of long playing things to a reasonable degree. So I like the marriage between skill fit and sort of curve of development. that they're trying to blend here.
Yeah, and a coherent philosophy in terms of what they're doing. Whereas, you know, if you were still in an era with Pascal and OG, maybe, yeah, Da Silva, a Dalton Connect, someone like that. And obviously those guys didn't slide, but maybe those guys are of more interest because they can come in. And similar to Jaime Jaquez last year, you know, maybe there's a higher day one value, but what is that guy going to be, you know, what is that player going to develop into by the end of his rookie scale contract, which is when Scotty Barnes is going to be at the peak of his powers and things like that, is an important consideration. Not the greatest of drafts anyway. So at 19, you probably weren't going to get someone you were crazy excited about, but this is a deep draft. It's called a flat draft. Potential for the Raptors to get someone at 31 that they were considering at 19. Like we'll almost definitely hear Dan Tolsman or Bobby Webster say something like that at some point if they use the pick at number 31. The Knicks got 6 seconds for number 24. I don't know. What are you thinking with the 31 pick? I know there's like 15 different ways they could go. So you don't have to predict it. But what's front of mind for you heading into 4 p.m.?
You know, I sort of always default to they'll use the pick on a guy they like. Like that's just always the safe bet. And sure, the Knicks made that trade, but the Thunder have, by my count, like 550 second round picks. So if they're the team that traded up for, I believe it was the 26th pick or something like that. And so if you have that many second round picks and you see any marginal value to gain, it like behooves you to overspend to get that marginal value, especially when, you know, you're already a team that is knocking on you're in your championship window already. Like they pushed Dallas to 6 games. That series could have gone either way. You know, I'm sure the Raptors, if they get offered like a pick in the late 30s and another asset, they should think about it, especially because if it's a future draft asset, those drafts promise to be probably better than this one, even if it might not be the flat sort of draft that might actually give this 31st pick a bit more value than in past, than in future drafts, because, you know, like you're saying the Raptors will, there's probably a bunch of teams out there saying, oh, we had like a, you know, our 22nd guy is still on the board. That might not be the case next year, but you know, they have so many needs and so many, and trades are just hard to pull off, I think. And this team hasn't done a ton of draft trading recently. I expect them to sit there and take a guy they like. And, you know, there's a few interesting names on the board. Kyle Filipowski is still there, you know, a Duke Olenek, if you want. There's Tyler Smith, the G League forward, big, a few other guys. So, and then, you know, there's the Raptors penchant to totally go off the board. You know, I'll say the name Bronny James for the ratings and, we can move on.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, if they're going off the board, it's tough going off the board at 31. Cause like, then you're like, oh, should we wait undrafted and trade down or whatever? Like, yeah. But if they pick Nafali Dante or something like that, like, yeah, it's not going to, it'll surprise people. And then everyone will be like, of course they went way off the board at 31. Quickly before we pivot to Blue Jays here for a couple of minutes, Eric, Bruce Brown, the team has to make a decision on that tomorrow, picking up his option. They have to pick up the option if they intend to trade him, whether at draft day, whether on July 1st or July 6th. What is your current read on that or lean on that? I know not from a reporting standpoint, but like reading the tea leaves and analyzing, where do you lean on that one?
I've always been under the assumption that they would pick it up if it came to it, just to keep the trading window open. You know, just quick, dirty math. They can't really create meaningful cap space unless they declined his team option and then let Gary Trent Jr. walk in free agency. And even then it's getting you to, you know, $26 million-ish. And there aren't many starter caliber players out there in free agency, at least ones that would actively consider Toronto. So, but with how many teams need to create or might need to create space in order to duck the first or second aprons and save themselves some money, that $26 million could be more valuable than Bruce Brown. I have a tough time believing it would be more valuable than both Brown and Trent. So I am guessing if there's no trade made that they will hold on to him. But I'm certainly not positive about that. You know, I think you can make a compelling case otherwise, but that would sort of depend on the what they're hearing in terms of the teams that would be looking to create more room for themselves and what the value of having that cap space, not in terms of acquiring players to help you, but saving other teams money would be. So if they can say, clear, you know, get a first round pick out of that, you have to sort of consider waiving or declining the option on Bruce Brown. But we'll see. Luckily, only one day until we find out.
Yeah, we'll find out by tomorrow at the latest. We'll find out today if he gets dealt as part of the second round. So a lot of cap wrinkles there. And even though I'm hosting a Jay show, this is not for you, Eric. This is for other Raptors people. You just ask me if you're not clear on the cap stuff instead of putting cap misinformation out there. I'm happy to answer questions about it. Okay, so you guys spoke to Bobby Webster last night. I assume you'll speak to someone else from the front office today. We are going to speak to Ross Atkins at 3 p.m. today down at Rogers Center. This is just we don't get this on basketball where the GM will just meet with the media semi-regularly. It's just not a part of the way the NBA works, really. It is in baseball. Ross Atkins is not going to say anything of interest. He's going to say this is just as disappointing for them as the fans. They understand there's still a bit of time here, et cetera, et cetera. If you could, and this is a J.D. Bunkus gimmick, if you could fire up a truth serum and ask Ross Atkins one question that he will answer truthfully, what question would you ask?
How could you? I'm joking. I think the question I'm most interested in and I'd want details on is, like, obviously they pushed hard for Shohei Ohtani. I'd want to know how different the budgets were in terms of with Ohtani and without. And the reason I'd want to know that is, you know, the easy criticism, I think, is that there was no, at least we couldn't see it develop, no strong plan B in terms of really helping the offense from last year if they didn't get Ohtani. And when you look back at free agency, you can, you know, whether it was trading for Tyler O'Neill or it was going harder after Juan Soto, like there were things you could have done before Shohei Ohtani made his decision that might have supplemented the offense that basically sunk them through the first, you know, 2.5 months of the season. So if I could get a truthful answer about what the restrictions were in terms of how he spent the money that Rodgers gives him, and I will remind people that the Jays have a pretty aggressive payroll overall when comparing them. So I'm not here to say they're not spending enough, but they clearly made some decisions on how to spend that money. And if they're willing to spend for Ohtani, who, you know, would have brought a lot of money to the organization, how different was the budget without him? Or could they have pivoted earlier to a plan that made this maybe a more balanced team than we've seen, even though the offense is coming around in the fake ballpark that is Fenway Park?
Okay, so you have, yes, fake, very fake. Vlad, 1.05 career OPS there. Yeah, he would crush there forever. Okay, so this question is going to blend Raptors and Blue Jays and just your general sports coverage over the years. So one of the questions JD and I were kicking around a little earlier, and I've kind of kicked around on the show, and as much as I don't want to, like, overdo someone's job security or whatever, the things have not gone well for the Blue Jays. This is 8 years into this front office. And the idea of letting someone who, you know, helped get you into the situation try to steer out of it when their job security is not particularly clear, that's tough for me intellectually. If you're a lame duck, if you're potentially going to, like, get let go at the end of the season, if that's likely, you know, why is this guy operating the trade deadline then? And we've seen on the Raptors side in the past, you know, like Rob Babcock got let go before trade deadline season. Because, you know, that's not something you really want to operate with. But the Raptors let Brian Colangelo handle his final deadline before Masai Ujiri took over. What do you make of that element of it? Like, is that as a Jays fan, is that an area of discomfort for you as well? If they're going to sell, the person who's doing the selling right now might not be here long term?
Yeah, I don't like it. Like, I think human nature is to sort of try and do whatever it takes to save to create the best situation for you to stick around. It's, you know, basic survival instincts. And I'm not saying I don't know Ross Atkins. I'm not saying he would go there and do the thing that he thinks is best for him, even if it flies in the face of, you know, what the franchise should do. I you know, I would question how much the franchise would even consider, like, you know, something approaching a, not a full teardown, but, you know, a heavy sale, you know, based on what they've done with the stadium. But I don't, it's just an uncomfortable spot to put a guy who has to be thinking about his job security and say, we are entrusting you with the long-term welfare of this team because this year is probably not going to end in a playoff berth. You know, I know there's still a chance, but probably not going to end in a playoff berth. So do the right thing for the team, and then we'll think about how you, you know, how you fit in afterward. It takes some strong organizational alignment for that to be a healthy situation. And this isn't shade at the Jays. I think it's shade at just most organizations. I haven't seen many that really have that internal alignment and have it be consistent enough where I'd feel comfortable with it. So I don't, if he's not going to be in charge at the end of the year, I don't think he should be in charge at the trade deadline. And I'd say that about, you know, almost 99% of executives in a similar position.
And I think that that's fair. That's why intellectually I have an issue with it. And as a fan or as an analyst, you know, there's too much dissonance there. Eric, quick, before I let you go, you mentioned you kind of hand wave there, like, yes, it's not completely over. We're probably going to hear from Atkins today that they've still got a couple weeks to turn it around here. They're not going to make a decision. Even Ken Rosenthal, in your colleague at The Athletic, in a piece about the Jays today, said they look like certain sellers, but almost certainly will take as long as possible to choose that direction. They got four against the Yankees here at home. They've got four against the Astros here at home, and the Astros are the hottest team in baseball now, arguably, other than Grimes and the Mets. What would the next 2 weeks have to look like for you to give any sort of brain space to, yeah, maybe they won't sell?
Well, if it were me, like, I don't know. Like I said, I'm sort of skeptical about them selling in the first place just because I worry that they're going to kick this down the road as long as possible and maybe they run out of road in the bad way. But I think they've got to win every series they're playing, right? Like they got to, I don't know how many games it is. Let's say it's 12. They got to go 8-4, 9-3. And really set themselves up to make a push after the All-Star break. I haven't seen that all year. Now I know the Astros are on a run now, and everybody would have said they wouldn't have been capable of it a month ago. So I'm not going to rule it out. But like this is a team that even when it was skating by at 500 at the beginning of the year, like its run differential was pretty bad. It was like lose 10-1, lose 9-1, win 3-2, win 2-1, and like. There aren't many signs, and like the offense coming around a bit is maybe something you can, if you really want to hang your hat on something, you can say that. And but even now, like the bullpen is so dodgy without Garcia and a healthy and effective Romano that it's hard to see them winning games with the way they've scored runs for most of the season. So I don't see it with this team, but that's what it would have to look like for me to not want to see them sell at least at the very least under free agents to be who could bring some interesting, maybe, you know, major league or almost major league ready prospects back to the team.
It's tough. Gonna be a tough couple weeks to navigate. As the Raptors taught us, you maybe don't want to wait too long though, because then you don't get a full freight on your guys as you sell them. Eric Green of The Athletic, thanks for taking the time out, man. And best of luck with the last, 4 hours with the Raptors on the clock here.
Thanks, Blake. Be well.
Eric Green of The Athletic. If you want to learn more about Jacoby Walter, the player the Raptors picked 19th overall, you can go to The Athletic and check out Eric's write-up on that. You can also check out Michael Grange's work here at Sportsnet. The Raptors do have the number 31 pick, at least for right now. The draft continues at 4 o'clock today on Sportsnet, so you can check that out before the Jays game. And then lock in, because the Jays are playing four against the New York Yankees. We gave away tickets earlier in the week to send some of you down for tomorrow. If you're going down tonight, here's what you're looking at. This is a New York Yankees team that is 52-30, despite losing 6 of the last 7 and getting absolutely spanked by the Mets in the Subway Series. That is good for first in the American League East. despite dropping 6 of 7 and getting spanked the last couple games, they are still plus 97 in run differential. That's the fifth best in baseball. They are the number 5 offense in terms of run scoring. They're 3rd in OPS, 3rd in weighted runs created plus, 2nd in homers. The one thing they don't really do well is steal bases, and that's because everyone hits homers. You can't steal a base when you just went yard, and you probably don't want to run into outs with Aaron Judge and Juan Soto on the bases, so you're a little more conservative. On the pitching side, they are 6th in runs allowed per game. So we're talking about a top 6 run scoring team, top 6 run prevention team. They have the number 2 starting pitching ERA in all of baseball, and that's with only 2 games back from Gerrit Cole, one of them really bad. They also have the number 10 bullpen. So not a lot of holes here, even though they have Giancarlo Stanton, Anthony Rizzo, Jonathan Berti, all on the IL on the position player side. Enough so that they just had to trade old Blue Jays friend Jordan Groshans for J.D. Davis to plug in the infield at times here. Yes, Jordan Groshans continues to bounce around and hit nothing at all, even back down as low as Double A. They also have Clark Schmidt and Cody Petit on the IL from a pitching standpoint, as well as 6 relief pitchers. So this is a team that has had even worse luck than the Blue Jays from an injury standpoint. And yes, the highs are obviously higher there. Their stars are definitive superstars in Aaron Judge and Juan Soto. But this is a team that's had some bad breaks as well and kind of continues to get it done. So yeah, you can do that. You can do that. One thing to look out for the Blue Jays, obviously they're not a team that's stolen a ton of bases. They're not a team that's hit a ton of home runs. The Yankees have had trouble controlling the run game. A couple of their pitchers a little slower to the mound. Jose Trevino, similar to the Blue Jays catchers, a very good blocker and framer, not super great at controlling the run game. So maybe some opportunity there for the Blue Jays to go a little, not all the way small ball, but a little bit more of that, a little bit more try to steal base, a little bit more hit behind the runner. We saw them do that to good effect in the Boston game that they won before the big inning started. They kind of did both at the same time. You're going to see Carlos Rodon tonight, obviously a powerful lefty there who is, you know him at this point, and the ERA has come back down after a coldish start to the season. So he's coming in at 3.86. ERA, about a strikeout per inning. The Jays have seen him a fair amount, and the results are pretty mixed. Vlad is 4 for 6 against him with 3 walks, so that's a positive. In 76 plate appearances, though, no Blue Jay has homered off of him. You have a handful of guys who just went 0 for last time the Jays saw him. Kevin Kiermaier's 1 for 7 career. George Springer is 2 for 17 career. Justin Turner, 3 for 14. And again, very little in the way of extra base hits. So not a great track record for this Blue Jays team against Carlos Rodon. And again, we'll probably see some of the better bats out of the lineup because I'd imagine they'll want to go with at least a good amount of righties against Rodon, who again is a lefty, and I don't know that you're going to have Horwitz and Barger in there necessarily, or maybe if Varsho's back, you don't have Kiermaier in there or something like that. Rodon is his splits are pretty modest, but they're still there. On the other side, Jays are going to throw Jose Berríos. He's seen this Yankees team a bunch. They've actually hit him pretty well. The active Yankees have a 3.10 average against Jose Berríos in his time against them, so something to be aware of there. Jose Berríos has obviously been quite good for the Blue Jays. We'll continue to tee the rest of this series up in tomorrow's show. This is the nice thing about a 4-game series. We get kind of 2 kicks at setting the Yankees side of things up. Tomorrow is going to be Marcus Stroman against Yusei Kikuchi. Saturday will be Nestor Cortes against Chris Bassett. And then Sunday is Gerrit Cole against Kevin Gausman, which historically has kind of been a Cy Young battle matchup. Kevin Gausman's obviously struggled a little bit this year and kind of, you know, performed at like an average starting pitcher level. And then Gerrit Cole has only made 2 starts since returning from injury. One of those, a pretty encouraging 4 innings against Baltimore. And then the other one against the Mets where he got shelled pretty bad, gave up 4 home runs and walked 4 batters. So whatever strategy Gerrit Cole was using in that one to extend his outing, to command a little better and things like that, did not work particularly well. This is still Gerrit Cole, though, and I think you're going to, until he shows you otherwise in that game, you're going to treat him like he's Gerrit Cole. Okay, so Rodon against Berríos tonight. Mentioned it a little earlier. Votto had gotten back in some games. He is not in the lineup for any of the minor league teams today, but we are getting, Jaron Watts-Brown is in the middle of a pretty good start right now for Dunedin. Arjun Namala is back at that Dunedin level. We're keeping an eye on some things with AAA. Hagen Danner and Ryan Burr, who are bullpen depth, are both on the IL there. Jays get a bit of a break yesterday with the rain out. Not that you want to get your bullpen rested that way, but because it happened early in the game, no one had to come in to sub for Yariel Rodriguez. So nobody pitched yesterday. The Blue Jays should be in pretty good shape bullpen-wise heading into this series. Bowden Francis is available out of the bullpen as well. And because it is the first game of a series and back at home, we should get some updates on a Jordan Romano, on a Jimmy Garcia, and guys like that. We'll also hear from Ross Atkins at 3 p.m. today. Not sure if we're covering that live, but Blair and Barker will certainly have it for you 4 to 6, breaking all that down. They'll have Jay's talk for you after the game as well. But yeah, Ross Atkins, 3 o'clock. Wonder if he says anything other than what he always says. We'll be back tomorrow to break it down. Thanks. Have a good day.